With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, operating costs go up while prices go down. That's the hard news for pistachios this season. Ryan German reports on that in his headlines. But we start today with a talk about trade. Representatives from California were among those from 49 U.S. companies and organizations that joined USDA Undersecretary for Trade Alexis Taylor on a trade mission to South Korea. Taylor says the trade mission was a success and offered a lot of opportunities for California's specialty crops.
I think we are able to really expand in the showcase of what we can provide and what we can export and how that can really benefit Korean consumers. So from a California perspective, we had several California fresh fruit sectors represented, some of the tree nuts represented. And so while we have exports there, I think we are also looking to continue to grow and expand those. We're working on expanded market access, for instance, of nectarines. And so the Tree Fruit Association was there, obviously because they have some interest in already exporting, but looking towards potentially new market access for California nectarines. And so I think when we go into these markets, it is what we're currently exporting, but also looking for new market opportunities. Again, so important to the diversification work that we're doing. As we think about how do we diversify revenue streams, making sure we've got new markets for new products or open markets for existing products to expand into is really important.
Taylor points out it was one of several trade missions planned for the year.
Well, first off, we started the year in February where the Deputy Secretary Torres Smalls led our first ever trade mission to Angola. And we really saw great success in that trade mission. You know, Africa can have unique challenges. However, as we think about new diverse markets, Africa is a key part of the world to be looking at. By 2050, one in four people on the planet will live on the African continent. And so getting in now, building relationships now, I think is really important and a key part of the world, again, as we think about at USDA market diversification. Towards the end of April, we will be heading to India. Really excited. We have a strong U.S. delegation already signed up to go to India. Last year, the Biden-Harris administration were able to reduce tariffs on roughly 10 products to India in the food and ag space, a lot of our specialty crops. And we're really looking forward to, many of these tariffs were retaliatory tariffs during the last administration, and we really lost some pretty significant market share as a result. And so we're excited to be taking U.S. food and agricultural businesses back to begin the process of rebuilding that those consumers and rebuilding that market share. From after India, we will be heading to Canada, and we're doing a first ever tribal trade mission where we're taking U.S. Tribal-owned food and agricultural businesses and doing a focused tribal trade mission to Vancouver, and also doing some nation-to-nation building through Canada with Canada's Indigenous tribes and Indigenous peoples as well, really tapping into some historic traditional trade routes between our Indigenous peoples of North America. We're heading to Colombia in August. We will also be in Vietnam in the fall with buyers also from Thailand coming over. And then we will round out the year in Morocco with buyers from West Africa to join as well.
California Secretary of Agriculture Karen Ross also participated in the trade mission to South Korea to find opportunities for California exports. And now a look at wildfires in California and a possible way to reduce them. In 2023, California saw more than 7,000 wildfires and 300,000 acres burned. There were 4 fatalities and 71 structures damaged or destroyed. One tool we can use to combat wildfires is prescribed fires, or fires that are intentionally set and controlled by experienced teams. Joining us on the phone is fire advisor and the director of University of California's Ag and Natural Resources Fire Network, Lania Quinn Davidson. Fire, of course, is extremely important as a topic in California, and we wanted to talk today about prescribed burns. Most of our listeners, I'm sure, know what a prescribed burn is or a controlled burn is, but would you please go ahead and give us the official definition of that?
Sure. Well, the way I like to think about prescribed fire, it's the intentional use of fire as a tool under really specific conditions to meet objectives that you've identified in advance. So it's really versatile. It can be used for a lot of different things, but that key component is really that you have a specific objective and that you've identified the conditions that you'll need to get to that objective.
Prescribed fires have been used in several ways in California, but let's talk about for vegetation management, which is crucial in our area. How can prescribed fire be used for that?
I love that you asked this question because I think often people think specifically just about fuels reduction for prescribed fire and, burning up the leaves and the branches and the litter that can fuel future wildfire. But people use prescribed fire for all different forms of vegetation management, including range management, managing for trying to get rid of invasive species, invasive grasses, things that are a problem for rangeland owners, for getting rid of brush that might be encroaching into woodlands or prairies. There are a lot of different ways that you can use fire to design for the specific plant communities that you want on the landscape.
What are some of the ecological benefits of using prescribed fire?
Yeah, well, if you think about a place like California, and actually this is common across much of the United States, many of our ecosystems are adapted to frequent fire. Fires historically would have burned in some of these places, like in a lot of parts of California, every 5 to 10 years. And for so long, we removed fire from these places. We took it out of the system. And I liken it to removing rain or removing sunshine, removing a really important natural process that regenerates plants, that releases nutrients into the soil, that maintains healthy forest densities, things like that. So, by taking that out, we've had so many problems, including obviously increased wildfire risk, but also a lot of ecological impacts. And so, bringing fire back in restores a lot of those benefits to the landscape. And of course, has a lot of cultural benefits too, whether you're a native person who has, specific traditional connections to fire, or a rancher who's using it to manage for things that you need for your livelihood. There are just so many benefits.
On one hand, it seems counterintuitive to say, let's introduce fire to make things, grow better or to protect from fire. But then on the other hand, it really makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? How can the old saying, I'm going to throw it out there, fight fire with fire.
Yep.
How can we fight fire with fire? As we know, the wildfire situation in California is so tragic so often. So is there something we can do with prescribed fire to help on that front?
Absolutely. If we are able to implement more prescribed fire projects, we get to choose the time and the conditions under which those places are burning. So we can do it during really safe times of year. We can time it so the smoke's not as much of an issue for our communities. And then when fires come, and we know they will, right? We know that we will have future wildfire across most of California and across most of the Western US. When those fires come and they hit an area that's been recently burned with prescribed fire, they burn quite a lot differently. The fire behavior drops. It's a lot easier for crews to get in there and gain control. So, prescribed fire gives you all kinds of advantages, not only immediately for whatever objective it is you're trying to work from, but also for the next 5 to 10 years of potential wildfire impacts.
Do you feel like, in your expert opinion, and I'm going to just completely put you on the spot here, in your expert opinion, are we as a state using it as effectively as we could be? Or are there ways that we could be improving our use of prescribed burns?
There is a lot of attention directed at prescribed fire right now, and our state and federal agencies are really making strides at trying to do more and to implement more of these projects. There's also a huge movement within the community sector and the private sector to kind of reclaim this tool and to bring it back into the hands of landowners and ranchers and tribes and community members so that we can all play a role in it too. And that's a big part of the work that I do is really training, inspiring, empowering people to also have access to fire as a tool. People in California have been burning for thousands of years, and it's only a more recent phenomenon that it's so highly professionalized and that the only folks who are using it are like the Forest Service and CAL FIRE and groups like that. So We're really trying to open it up, get more people involved, more people trained, more jobs in this line of work, inspiring young people to get more involved because there is a lot more we could be doing. We need to be implementing more projects and we need to be, strategically placing those projects in places where they can have the most impact.
We will continue our conversation on prescribed fires with Lania Quinn-Davidson later in today's show. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, U.S. soy farmers recently gathered to discuss sustainable solutions for every life, every day. Chad Smith has more.
U.S. soy farmers across 30 states recently gathered together in Louisville, Kentucky for the Soy Checkoff's board meeting to discuss investments that bring forward sustainable solutions to every life every day. USB Treasurer Brent Gatton says one of the topics included looking ahead to checkoff work in 2025.
We're continuing our FY25 build out that we actually started at our December board meeting. So we have 77 directors on our board, and out of the 77 directors, they're split up into three priority working groups. It's health and nutrition, innovation technology, and infrastructure and connectivity. And in these groups this week, our primary objective was to get in these work groups, farmers get together, collaborate, brainstorm, put together their wish list of items and areas that they would like to see us invest checkoff dollars for FY25. So whether that be through research, education, or promotion, just trying to come up with ideas and ways to move the pile.
He talks about some of the top priorities for farmers.
One of the main things that we really want to focus on is, biofuel demand is it's just peaking up there for us, but we've got to do something with the meal. So now we're trying to find new ways to move the pile of meal, And one of the most exciting things that we invested in here recently was the Port of Grays Harbor. The investment and infrastructure study that we did there, we were able to increase our soybean meal exports to Southeast Asia from 3 million metric tons to 6 million metric tons. So it's ideas and things like that that farmers come up with that just help move the pile and give a positive return on investment for farmers back here in the United States.
Keep up with the latest news from the United Soybean Board at unitedsoybean.org and Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on RFD TV. Chad Smith reporting.
An Iowa report takes a look at how much it takes to get custom work done on the farm. Here's David Geiger.
A new survey shows what Iowa farmers are paying for custom work and services. Iowa State University Extension released the 2024 Iowa Farm Custom Rate Survey, including tasks from crop to field work. Ann Johans with Iowa State University Extension says it's their most heavily downloaded survey.
Other states try and duplicate what we've done with our custom rates, and they're not able to. And so the Iowa State University survey is used across the Midwest because custom rates are something, that can cross state lines more so than, say, our cash rent survey.
Johan says the survey shows cost data for what is expected to be charged or paid this year.
It is so important that we have, some transparency in custom rates and have the survey as a guide. But if anybody is doing custom work or hiring custom work done, it's so important to understand what your own costs are. If your equipment is unique and has some unique aspects, your skills are unique. If you have more experience or there's so many factors, and that any custom rate needs to cover the cost of the machinery, the cost of the operator.
The survey mentions increasing interest rates over the last 2 years. That, along with fuel prices, production challenges, and crop prices, impact custom rates.
I was surprised to guess that generally rates were down slightly, but I think also we've seen increases the last couple of years. And so sometimes, responses will kind of correct just to kind of balance what we've seen. So even with kind of slightly higher fuel prices, that those rates did across the board kind of go down, a few went up. But we saw more responses this year, which is awesome.
In total, 130 responses and 2,800 custom rates provided by state producers. And in some of the findings, corn combining cost an average $44.05 an acre, up $2.75 from 2023. Soybeans going for $42 an acre, $2.10 higher. Mowing hay kept at the same rate as last year, $13.85 an acre, although prices for baling large rounds did jump over $2 to $15.60 a bale. There were a few acres where rates fell in the last year, like soybean drilling at $18.85 an acre, down $1.35. The results of the survey can be found online at the ISU Extension website. In Des Moines, Iowa, I'm David Geiger reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's John Harith with the Livestock Report.
How much did pork and beef exports impact the value of corn in 2023? Dave Jude of the Jude Group did an analysis for the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
Red meat exports, that's both beef and pork, used about almost 513 million bushels of corn for feed. And if you take the calendar year average price in 2023 of $5.95, that's about $3.05 billion of corn purchases that were directly leveraged by red meat exports. We estimate that the value of red meat exports to a bushel of corn is about 87 cents. If you take that 87 cents per bushel and apply that across the whole 2023 corn crop, that's going to total $13.35 billion of additional revenue to corn production that wouldn't be there if there wasn't the demand from the red meat exports.
Red meat exports also accounted for the consumption of about 3 million tons of dry distillers grains, adding 4 cents per gallon to the net margin of ethanol plants. But what about soybeans?
The bushel equivalent to soybean meal consumed by hogs for pork exports is about 97 million bushels. And last year, the calendar year average price was about $14.07. So that would be $1.36 billion in value to soybean production. Pork exports in 2023 added about $1.95 per bushel value to soybeans, and $1.95 across 4.16 plus million acres adds up to about $8.12 billion.
For more about the impact of red meat exports on corn and soybean value, as well as state-by-state impact data, visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Operating costs for pistachio growers have been increasing over the past few years, with prices trending down. UC Cooperative Extension Specialist Brittany Goodrich detailed some preliminary estimates of updating cost return figures for California pistachios.
Overall, operating costs per acre since 2020 have increased by about 5% on average. So what I have is about $3,300 per acre in operating costs. That doesn't include any overhead or investment, of course, but that's up about 5% from what we have in that 2020 study, while revenues we're estimating. I have the average price of pistachio, which includes an average of the in-shell and the shelled product as well, which is about $1.86. And so our revenues are down about 12% from 2020, while inputs are up 5%.
The 8th Annual Feeding the Economy report shows that the food and agriculture industries contributed over $9.6 trillion to the U.S. economy in 2023. The report shows that food and agriculture represent a little over 20% of total U.S. output and represents an increase of nearly 12% from last year's report. Key findings include nearly 48.7 million total jobs, nearly $2.8 trillion in total wages, and more than $1.2 trillion in total taxes. Agriculture and manufacturing agricultural products each employed around 2.5 million people. Manufacturing of agricultural products experienced the fastest job growth, now accounting for almost 20% of America's manufacturing jobs. The report emphasizes the significant role these sectors play in supporting the U.S. economy, promoting understanding among policymakers and the public. In a recent blog post, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis M. Taylor highlighted the significance of trade for American agriculture. Total U.S. agricultural exports reached nearly $175 billion in 2023, contributing to the strength of the farm sector and the national economy. Taylor highlighted the crucial role that USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service played in facilitating trade wins, such as opening new markets, increasing exports, and removing retaliatory tariffs. FAS organized trade missions and food pavilions, resulting in millions of dollars in projected sales. In October of last year, USDA also launched the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program to target underserved markets with a focus on Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. Looking ahead to 2024, Taylor notes that USDA aims to diversify markets and expand U.S. product presence worldwide.
Cotton growers have additional resources and assistance available through the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol. Program Manager Tillman White explains that they've introduced an expanded field-level team for providing regional support for growers participating in the sustainability initiative.
Chaz Holt is serving as Director of Field Programs and will lead the team, which is also including myself serving as the Program Manager. The field-level grower enrollment specialists added to the team provide not only cotton industry resources and networks, but also the ability to tailor their services to the unique needs of the Cotton Belt region they serve. Grower enrollment specialists, including Bailey Neeson, Smith serving the High Plains and West Region, Willis Fraser in the Mid-South, and Marin Finley for the Southeast. This team can aid producers with finalizing trust protocol enrollment and data entry, as well as applications for the Climate Smart Cotton Program ahead of the quickly approaching April 30th deadline.
The Soil Health Academy will be hosting a course detailing practical and profitable implementation of regenerative and holistic approaches to farming with an emphasis on water. The course will take place as an on-farm school at the Burroughs Family Almond Orchard April 30th through May 2nd in Denaire, where they produce almonds and walnuts and use animal integration. It will feature instruction, demonstrations, and insights from world-renowned soil health pioneers along with other orchard, vineyard, and vegetable production experts. Attendees will learn about how to improve water efficiency, reduce runoff during heavy rains, improve pest resistance and reduce the cost of spraying, save time and labor costs through less irrigation, and produce more profits per acre. Special attention will be directed towards the unique challenges and opportunities of the nut industry. More information about the course is available at soilhealthacademy.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Where the world's farms are located has shifted over time. Rod Bain has more coming up on This Land of Ours.
Among the findings of a recent USDA study on transformation of agricultural production, progression, and shift towards sustainability over a six-decade period, land in global ag grew 8% during that time frame. One aspect of this that study co-author and USDA research economist Keith Fugley found interesting was the primary location of this growth.
The location of where that output is coming from has really shifted from what we call in the report the global north. That's kind of the high-income countries of North America, Europe, and then Asia Pacific, like Japan and Australia. And it's shifted to the global south, Latin America, Africa, and the rest of Asia.
Irrigated area grew by over two times between 1961 and 2020.
It uses about two-thirds of the world's surface area. Irrigation uses about 70% of the world's freshwater resources.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Here's Cindy Zimmerman.
Here at the ACE Fly-In in Washington, D.C., I'm speaking with Ron Alverson, Dakota Ethanol. And Ron, GREET is the word here that we've been hearing, but I don't think a lot of people really understand what we're talking about as far as the GREET model is concerned and what the issue is, what the holdup is in getting the changes. And I thought you explained it very well yesterday, especially comparing it to the other model that is based on projections, while GREET is based on real life. So explain that a little bit to us.
Yeah, well, GREET stands for greenhouse gases, regulated energy, and regulated emissions and energy used in technologies. Mm-hmm. And it was developed way back in about 1995 by a guy by the name of Michael Wong, and he's at Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois. And back then they decided, you know, we need to have a life cycle assessment of how much greenhouse gases it takes to produce a unit of energy, and per million BTU, per megajoule type stuff like that. So he embarked on determining that on all the different fuels that are known to man. So he did gasoline and crude oil and diesel fuel and all this stuff. So everything has got a carbon footprint, we call it, but it's in terms of grams per million or kilograms or grams or, you know, whatever unit of energy it is per million BTUs of energy, so, or per unit of greenhouse gases per unit of energy. So, and he's been doing that for a long time, and it's kind of become the gold standard of life cycle greenhouse gas emissions accounting for the planet, really. Everybody, I think there's 50,000 users now around the planet that use this model. In the IRA legislation, they determined that the guys that were putting that together said that greed has to be used, or similar methodologies has to be used to determine the carbon intensity of these fuels that can earn tax credits for their reduction in carbon intensity. There's a competing model in Europe called CORSIA. CORSIA uses GREET emissions factors, but about the only difference between the CORSIA and the GREET model is CORSIA had used a different method to determine land use changes from biofuels. GREET uses their own method, and they update that every year. The CORSIA model, their land use change emissions were determined, I think, about at least 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, and they haven't updated that assessment since then. So it's old. Now there's this battle going on that CORSIA, that the folks that don't like biofuels would rather see the CORSIA model used because it gives biofuels a higher land use change. So it's kind of a philosophical thing. And everybody else, I shouldn't say everybody else, but the proponents of biofuels like the GREET model because it has a lower land use change penalty. So that's kind of how it's set up now. And there's this debate going on. And this debate is dragging on and has pushed this announcement back of what exact model is going to be used for the SAF tax credits and, well, I think the 40... is a 40H for hydrogen. That's kind of done, but so that's kind of the basis of it.
Well, do you think any changes need to be made in the GREET model to use it for the intention to use it to implement these tax credits?
No, we don't think so, because GREET looks at that stuff every year for land use change, and they make adjustments as it goes on based on what's happened. Now, the CORSIA model, if it was, you know, it's done 10 years ago, really was, we had no idea what the effect of biofuels over the, on land use change over those last 10 years were going to be. So it was a guess back then. And there was a lot of guesses back then about the impact of biofuels on land use change. But we much prefer something that's kind of based on what actually happened. So that's really the debate. But the biofuel opponents, they love that, or they like that. They use that against biofuels.
But also, I mean, they're talking about being able to put the climate-smart ag practices into the model. How would that look to you?
Well, GREET has been working on that, and ACE has been working really hard with Michael. We've got a great relationship with Michael. Mm-hmm. And we kind of started talking to Michael and his team about this, you know, over the last 5 years. And so they developed what's called the GREET feedstock, biofuel feedstock calculator. It's a separate module of the GREET module itself, but it just looks at the biofuel, the feedstocks that are used at biofuels, and they let users use that little calculator to determine the biofuel feedstock CI, separate from the GREET model, and you can do that in the feedstock calculator, and then it interacts with the GREET model, so you can get a good, what we call an upstream biofuel feedstock footprint, add that to the downstream stuff that's done on ethanol plants, the energy and electricity used at ethanol plants, and combine that all into one. Now, the full GREET R&D model, they call it, assumes that the biofuel feedstock footprints are U.S. Midwest average. But U.S. Midwest average doesn't reflect what's happening in different regions of the Corn Belt or of the Midwest. So it's a big step in the right direction. So, and the tools are in place to get this all done. We just need to work on the auditing and verification of what's actually happening on those farms. They're using USDA data, heavily use USDA data. USDA surveys a lot of stuff, but it just needs to be more extensive to determine exactly what's happening.
And as the latest census numbers came out, they show that farmland has decreased over the last 10 years, right?
Yeah, and that was such a powerful report, and I think it really changed the projection of the discussion that's going on land use change. So that was very helpful. So we're pretty confident that hopefully we'll get a good outcome here.
Well, do you think that, of course this is a dumb question, but do you think it's all political science?
It sure is, Cindy. You know, the biofuel opponents are very vocal. You know, there's a group of them out there that are, you know, got a lot of influence behind them that think EVs are the silver bullet. We shouldn't be working on anything else because it just slows down EV adoption. So it's a philosophical, political discussion.
Well, we're here at the ACE conference and on Capitol Hill. So not as many people here as there has been in the past, but what do you think about ethanol producers and supporters being involved in making their voices heard?
Oh, gosh, you know, I think it's a necessary, really. We just have to get out there and tell people, keep people informed of what's going on out here because there's so much misinformation. You know, if we get out-shouted in the media by biofuel opponents, you know, we're just going to lose that battle. So we have to tell the story.
All right. Thank you very much. Here at the American Coalition for Ethanol's annual fly-in, I'm Cindy Sigelman.
We continue now our conversation with fire advisor and the director of University of California's Ag and Natural Resources Fire Network, Lena Quinn Davidson. Let's talk about policy. Are we in need of any policy changes? Do we have good policy already? Where are we at with that?
We have made some incredible strides in prescribed fire policy in California in the last 3 years. One of the big things that we did is implemented a state burn boss program. So this program was mandated by legislation back in 2018. And what it did is create a certification pathway for private people, whether they be landowners or private contractors or, you know, foresters, that they can gain certification to be able to plan and implement prescribed fire. And then with more recent policy changes, we've added liability protections for those folks. So we changed the liability standard in California to provide a gross negligence standard for fire suppression costs, which I know that sounds like a lot, but basically what it means is that if you're doing a burn and you're doing everything right and something weird happens and you need support from CAL FIRE to come in and help you get it under control, that you won't be billed for that. And that's a huge benefit for the prescribed fire community and really to incentivize more of this work. The other thing that we did that is truly monumental is that we developed a $20 million state-backed claims fund, which is kind of like a state-backed insurance fund for prescribed fire, so that private landowners, private burn bosses, cultural burners can basically get free insurance coverage for prescribed fire from the state and make sure that we're covering the liability in case anything goes wrong.
It's not something I would have thought of because I obviously don't go out and do prescribed fires myself, but it actually makes a lot of sense trying to promote this perfectly safe practice when done correctly. But, you know, I'm sure it's not common. It's got to be rare that something, you know, out of the normal happens and maybe something gets out of control and you have to call for backup from the fire department. I think if I were somebody who actually does perform these prescribed burns, you know, that I had some protection in that situation would make me feel a lot better, you know, just about using this method at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what I always say is that a lot of this policy work that we're doing is really about gaining comfort and managing our own perceived liability. We know that this practice is safe. We know that when we do it, we put so much planning into it, but weird things can happen. And, you know, if people are doing this work for public benefit, which they are, most of these prescribed fire projects are really targeting ecological and social values that we all care about. We need to provide protections and comfort for those folks. They're doing us all a service. So the policy work in recent years has been pretty innovative, and California is on the cutting edge of a lot of this prescribed fire policy work, which is really cool to see.
What about other states? Can we talk about other states?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
You know, I'm not real familiar with how prescribed fire is used in other states, but I do broadcast in several other areas.
Oh, cool.
And so if we can talk Michigan, Indiana, I don't know much, you know, I say much, I don't know anything at all about prescribed fire in those areas. I know I don't see them on the news nearly as much suffering from wildfire problems as I do in California. For people in those states, should they be thinking about prescribed fire for, you know, again, for vegetation management, for land health?
Absolutely. Yeah. I work with people across the country who are using prescribed fire for various projects related to vegetation management or habitat restoration, fire risk reduction. And even in places like Michigan and Indiana and across the Great Plains and the southeastern U.S., there is a lot of interest in prescribed fire and a lot of people who use it. And so I recommend that if people are interested in learning more in those places, look into your statewide prescribed fire councils. I know that Michigan has a prescribed fire council, more than 30 states do. So this is definitely something that's nationwide, a lot of interest, a lot of movement, a lot of policy work going on, and opportunities for people to get involved.
Would you like to talk about the Southeast a little, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Southeast is really a leader in prescribed fire. The Southeastern U.S. has been the place where that cultural connection to prescribed fire was never lost in the same way that it was in the Western U.S. We in the Western U.S. skipped generations where people weren't burning. We lost that knowledge and that skill. And in the Southeastern U.S., because of the nature of the forests that they have down there, you know, forests like the longleaf pine that require fire every 1 to 2 years in order to stay healthy and to persist, people are much more connected with prescribed fire as a tool. Florida, for example, burns 2 million acres a year with prescribed fire, where in California, we are struggling to get 100,000 acres a year. So I do just want to highlight that a lot of the cool work that we've done in California has been inspired by other parts of the country. And I think it's important for us to be learning from each other and visiting those places and really talking to people about, you know, the value of fire as a tool. So Florida in particular has been a big inspiration to me in my work in California, and so have the Great Plains. So places like Nebraska and Oklahoma, they have incredible prescribed fire programs. And many of those programs in the Great Plains are led by ranchers and farmers. And so the role of agriculturalists in prescribed fire work is notable and really something that I've tried to infuse into my work in California. So I work a lot with the California Cattlemen's Association. You know, those groups, they might not seem like obvious leaders in prescribed fire, but the more you talk with them, they've used fire for generations. Ranchers really are one of the original user groups of prescribed fire in California and across the country.
It's really interesting to me when you talk about the cultural connections, and then you talk about we've gone generations where we've kind of lost some of that knowledge. It's really interesting to me to think about that type of a connection to fire and to this technique of using it.
Yeah, you know, there's something so human about the use of fire. And I think this is one of the things I love about bringing people out on their first prescribed burn, is that they might go into it kind of scared or nervous or intimidated. And then pretty soon you just look over and they're smiling and they're like, this feels so natural somehow. You know, humans have always used fire. It's a very human practice. So there is a cultural connection there. And a lot of what the work that I do, we use that term culture. We're trying to inspire culture change around how we relate to fire. And I think we've really diverted so far from our natural tendency toward fire and our natural comfort with fire. And that's the source of a lot of the problems we're having in California. Our landscapes need fire, but we need it too. And so how can we rebuild that connection?
It's an important conversation, especially for California. That's today's South Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.